From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 12, 2018, when a woman named Lindsay was having an argument with her mother. She loved her mom, but she was frustrated by her family's ongoing emotional struggles. And she told her mother, "I wish somebody could snap their fingers and fix this. Just explain why this doesn't work. I don't understand." And her mother's reaction was confusing at first. Her mom paused and then asked if she was in a good mental place and then sat down to tell her the truth. Lindsay had grown up with her mom and dad in the Rochester area between Rochester and Buffalo. And like most kids, she assumed her mom and dad were her biological mother and father. She wasn't told otherwise. Her mother explained that she had gone through a sperm donor to conceive, but she had never told Lindsay. She had wanted Lindsay to think, at least for a time, that her dad was her biological father. And the revelation carried enormous implications for Lindsay. She began to understand why she might be having trouble with certain things, like ways of learning or mental health. Her dad was still her dad, but he was not her biological father, and Lindsay wanted to know who her biological father was. She also began to wonder, do I have siblings I've never met? The answer to that was beyond what she could have imagined. When Lindsay was able to track down information on the donor who was her biological father, she found out that he had been a prolific donor in the 1990s. She had at least 20 siblings spread across several countries. That number has now grown to 31 total siblings, 28 of whom were donor conceived. 14 of her siblings were born in 1994 alone. Lindsay was born in 1995. Four of her siblings went to a high school together without knowing they were related. The process of finding her brothers and sisters has been emotional. It's been empowering in ways, at times difficult. She wonders if there are more siblings that she will never meet. She has loved getting to know them. Some are less involved in her life, while others are just as close as twins might be. But many of her siblings have wondered why the law prevents them from having a right to this information. For donor-conceived children, there are significant barriers to finding out who they are related to and what implications that might have in their own lives, including to their health, by the way. This story to me is fascinating, but it's not just fascinating. It is painful and difficult to understand what all of this means. So let's try to understand the issues, and let's meet some of the remarkable members of this still-growing family. And we welcome now Lindsay Roble to Connections. Welcome back to the program. It's been a little while since we have talked. Thank you for being with us, Lindsay.
Yeah, of course. Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me again.
Later this hour, we will welcome some of your siblings. And in fact, we'll meet the man who made a TikTok that went viral. That is your brother.
Yep, that's my brother, Andy. He is the newest addition to the group.
I'll post the TikTok on my platforms if people want to check it out later. Essentially, it's a short story introducing the siblings. Most of your siblings participate. How many are on that video?
Oh, geez. I think it's most of us, but it's definitely not all of us. I think maybe like 18 or 19 of us are in that video. Definitely missing quite a lot, though. You can't fit 31 people into a minute.
Well, I want to be clear with listeners, just as I was with Lindsay before the program, that part of the reason we want to do this program is so we understand what the advocacy part of this is, why these siblings who continue to find one another also want to see the rules or the laws change to make it easier for others to understand themselves better. For me, calls to mind a recent op-ed written by Steve Inskeep, who is a co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. And it's not exactly the same story, but there are some of the same threads. He wrote for the New York Times under the headline, "For 50 years, I was denied the story of my birth." Now, it's about adoption. Yeah, it's about adoption. And Steve Inskeep says, my parents told me early that I was adopted, but that was all that I knew and that was all they knew. Indiana, like mm-hmm. most states, practiced closed adoption, meaning birth families and adoptive families were allowed no identifying information about each other. Secrecy was considered best for everyone concerned. In recent decades, open adoption has been replacing this practice, but rules governing past adoptions changed slowly, and I was barred from seeing my birth records. Everything I just told you about my biological parents was unknown to me growing up. They were such a blank, I could not even imagine what they might be like, end quote. So, Lindsay, I want to start by asking you, I think listeners are more familiar with the ongoing sort of debate that there's been among the adoptive community about whether but whether those records should be open, whether the laws should force them open. Is this a similar sort of debate in the community that is, and I'm going to try to use the term that I think is the correct term, a donor conceived, is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, is it a similar issue in that community?
Yeah, so there are actually a lot of parallels with the adoptive community, and I definitely feel some kinship with folks who are traditionally adopted. I've jokingly referred to myself as half adopted on more than one occasion. But yeah, the fight for adoptees to have access to, you know, their biological origins is one that many people understand both emotionally and, like academically, like they understand the reasons they can feel for those people who want that. And so very often when I'm trying to explain this to people, I sort of invoke that struggle that adoptees go through and will say, you know, if you believe that adopted children should have access to their biological parents, then why shouldn't I, you know? And I think definitely a lot of the same conversations are happening in the donor conceived community because, you know, in the 90s, my parents, many of my siblings' parents were told by the banks and by their doctors never to tell us that we were donor conceived. They were told to keep it a secret and that was what was best for the family. But just like it's coming out that adopted children do, you know, have the best outcomes when they're told so young that they can never remember finding out, we're finding out a similar thing about donor conceived children, that they should be told young and it should always be part of their story.
Well, we're going to get to the advocacy piece more with you coming up here. Let's just understand the story. And I did my best to sort of frame it out for listeners, but you know, you grew up with a mom and a dad. I know your dad has passed away. But in your own mind, until you were in your 20s, mom and dad were biological mom and dad. Tell me a little bit about what it was like, what the emotion was like finding out that was not the case for your dad.
Yeah. So I spent my whole life just assuming that my parents were my biological parents. I also grew up with a younger brother who, as it turns out, my parents used a different donor for. He has 36 siblings. But it was finding out, one, made a lot of sense. It sort of clicked in my head why, you know, I was shorter than both my parents, why I didn't really look like my dad, why my temperament was very different than his. But, you know, there was like a sense of sadness and a sense of betrayal and loss because I felt, you know, like my identity, my right to know who I was at my core had been taken away from me. And my immediate reaction upon finding out was actually, I don't care. It doesn't matter. Dad is still my dad. I didn't actually care until my mom told me that she thought I might have siblings. And only at that point did I care. But it didn't change, you know, that I felt that my dad was my dad. And in fact, I think the 11 months that we had together before he passed, in which I knew that I was donor conceived and the secret was out, our relationship was considerably better for having the truth out in the open. But it was, you know, it was hard realizing that my parents, the two people I'm supposed to be able to trust the most in the world, had effectively lied to me my entire life about who I was.
You also mentioned to me before the program that there is a real value in transparency because you're going to make decisions for your own health based on maybe some family markers. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So donor conceived children and, you know, especially donor conceived children who don't know that they're donor conceived are working on faulty medical histories. A couple of my siblings who didn't know that they were donor conceived growing up dealt with debilitating migraines, and their doctors didn't have an adequate medical history to know that there was a family history of migraines, and their parents never told them otherwise. And so they potentially didn't get the treatment that they needed for years. For me, you know, I was unaware that there was a family history of like ADHD and depression, and also didn't receive adequate treatment for those things for years. And I found out also So when donors donate, they are typically approached when they're in college. So, you know, early 20s. And in most people's early 20s, their parents are still alive. Their grandparents are still alive. So you don't have that piece of the medical history yet. But, you know, a quarter of a century later, when I found my siblings and I found my donor, both of his parents and all of his grandparents had passed away. And finding out, you know, what caused their deaths was incredibly important to me. I now know that of the people in my donor's family that smoked, many of them developed lung cancer. So that, you know, informs my decision on being a casual smoker, because I know that my risk for lung cancer is like much higher than I previously thought it was when I thought that my dad was my biological father. And updating medical history like that is something that donors are not required to do. And can have devastating effects. I'm a part of a Facebook group that has a lot of donor-conceived people in it, and many of them, their whole lives, suffered with genetic medical conditions and then found out that they were donor-conceived and that those conditions came from their donor's side. And, you know, in some cases, were never listed on the donor paperwork.
Wow. Yeah, that alone, to me, makes it pretty straightforward. I mean, that's... Yeah. A set of information that seems like anyone would have a clear right to have if that information was out there. And you know, I mean, I said to Lindsay before this program that I didn't want to make this a conversation that was just about the oh my God aspect of this story, because it's an amazing story. And in a moment, I do kind of want to get into some of the stuff that has been, I hope, really transformative in a good way for Lindsay and meeting her siblings and understanding who they are and trying to find them and what that's been like. But there really is a serious edge to this. And that's part of why, you know, we're having this conversation at all. And I would encourage anyone listening right now, just think about what it would be like to find out that, for example, your dad is not a biological father. Again, that's not to say anything about people who are adopted, all the different sort of kinds of families there are. I'm just saying if your thought about your dad is that is also your biological dad, and it turns out that is not the case, what might that do to your mindset about things? What would you want to know? Well, my guest is someone who had to deal with that and now is doing this advocacy work. But let's kind of go back to what it was like to think, oh my God, I've got siblings out there. You told me that You told me that you found some of your sister's Instagrams and you messaged them what, that same night?
I found out pretty late at night on February 12th that I was donor conceived. And my mom mentioned that she had looked up my donor number on the donor sibling registry and saw that a couple of sisters had registered under that donor. And she thought that she had maybe found my sister Brittany's Twitter. And that gave me the idea to cross-check the donor sibling registry usernames with other social media. And I found Mackenzie and Brittany's Instagram accounts, and they had, you know, some pictures of the sibling meetup that had happened in Mexico with each other. So I was like, okay, so yeah, these people are donor conceived. They're probably my sisters. And I messaged both of them, and Mackenzie, you know, I didn't sleep that night. So this was probably at like 5 or 6 in the morning. And Mackenzie was an EMT at the time, and she pretty immediately messaged me back because she was up early for a shift and was like, hi, yeah, yep, you're my sister. There are a lot of us. And at the time that I found everybody, I was number 20, which felt crazy, but, you know, we found 11 more siblings since then. But she called me and we had a conversation, and I took the dive right in approach and immediately got added to all the group chats and the Snapchat group and was video calling with people. And it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. But I think the first thing that really blew my mind was that my mom was sitting next to me when Mackenzie called me, and she immediately was like, that's your voice on the other end of the phone, because Mackenzie and I sound very, very similar on the phone. And then, you know, I remember having a long FaceTime call with my sister Emily later that day, and Emily and I look a lot alike. And it was just so, the experience of seeing my face and my mannerisms and vocal inflections and personality traits in all of these people that I didn't know existed 12 hours prior was trippy.
What did that do to your thoughts on the idea of nature and nurture?
Yeah, so it's interesting. A lot of my siblings who have known their whole lives or who found out when they were younger children don't feel as strongly about this as a lot of us who found out as adults. I spent my whole life thinking, you know, oh, I'm not like my parents. I'm my own person. I'm an individual. And then I found my siblings and I was like, oh, my whole personality is genetic. Okay. And I've found, you know, just so many similarities in my personality and my political beliefs. And, you know, I mean, there are a huge number of us that are vegetarian or vegan. I firmly believe that our personalities and who we are is much more genetic than previously thought. And that's something that actually really riles a lot of people up, because that's not to say that, you have this like predetermined destiny of who you're going to become. Sure. And that you can't, you know, avoid it. But I do think that, at least for me, I've found that I understand who I am and why I am the way I am so much better now for knowing my siblings. And it has done wonders for my mental health to, you know, really know myself that way.
How many are you? Well, I don't want to sort of rank your siblings, but are you really, really close and tight with some of them?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. They're my best friends. Some of them are. And like, I obviously, in a group this big, you're going to be closer with some than you are with others. But I talk to probably at least two of them. And it's a different two every day. But I can't remember the last day where I didn't talk to at least one of them. They, whether it's in a group chat or a text or whatever, they mean the world to me. And I feel it sucks that I have to feel lucky for being allowed to know my siblings, but I feel very fortunate that they, you know, get to be a part of my life, because they're wonderful people and they're interesting people and they help me know myself better. Sometimes it feels like walking down a hall of mirrors, but like in a really cool way.
Wow. Talking to Lindsay Robel, who is an advocate for transparency when it comes to laws, regulations, and the rules for donor-conceived children. She was donor-conceived, found out in her 20s that that was the case, and is now learning more about her 30 siblings who are spread as... I asked Lindsay initially, most of you in New York State, and you laughed at that. Where are all of you? You're the only one here.
Yeah, I'm the only... No, actually, I used to be the only one in New York.
You used to be, okay.
We recently found a family of four brothers, and one of them goes to RIT, actually. So I've got a brother nearby, which is still crazy to me. But, you know, we have people in California, in Arizona, in Washington State. We have people in Utah, Chicago, Denver, Florida, Columbus, Ohio. I'm in New York. We have people in New Jersey. We have people in Boston. I have a sister that lives in Colombia. I have a brother that lives in the UK, and a sister that's moving to Germany in a couple days. So really, like, everywhere.
Yeah, and yet so many, you know, sort of different stories, but so many similar aspects of, as you mentioned, personality, even the little mannerisms and quirks. Is that eerie, or does that make you feel, I mean, is there anything sort of, I guess what I want to know is there any relief to this? And I ask because you've been so open about how, what a struggle it was to say, why am I so different from my parents? Why do we not get along in certain ways? Why are we so different to how we deal with conflict? And then you start to learn more about this. Is there any relief that comes?
Oh, absolutely. Oh my God, absolutely. Like, when you grow up your whole life knowing that you're different, and I think that that's an experience that a lot of donor-conceived children have, you know, not all of us, for sure, we're not a monolith, but I feel that a lot of donor-conceived children that I've spoken to have that experience of growing up and, like, knowing that something is wrong, you know, and just knowing finally what it is, being able to put your finger on that intangible thing that has been driving your life behind the scenes for the entirety of your life, is just feels like the weight of the world has been lifted off my shoulders. I feel, you know, that someone's identity belongs to them, is their property. And I, getting to see myself reflected in my siblings, even just finally understanding where my face comes from. Like, I always knew that I kind of looked like my mom, but not really, and always had a very weird relationship with how I looked. And finally, being able to look in the mirror and understand where I got my eyes, where I got my forehead, where I got the shape of my face has been, I can't even tell you the relief. It's, I think, something that every donor conceived child deserves, to just finally understand themselves.
So before we bring in a couple of your siblings, let me just ask you a little bit about your biological father, because it turns out that of the 28 donor conceived siblings that you know of, and that has been a growing group over the years, so there might be more. There are differences in how the biological father is viewed. You mentioned to me that you think of him almost more like an uncle, but you do have a relationship with him. Take us through that.
Yeah, so I don't have a particularly close relationship with Daly. His name is Daly. We talk on occasion, and I do have a relationship with his children. They're younger. We kind of affectionately refer to them as the littles. But, you know, some of us do have a very close relationship with Daly, and some of us have never spoken to him. And I will say he is generally really good about respecting whatever kind of relationship an individual wants to have with him. He doesn't, you know, like after my dad died, he was super respectful and didn't, you know, I told one of my sisters to convey to him that I didn't want to talk to him until I felt ready after that happened. And he totally respected that and let me, you know, process on my own and didn't reach out until I was ready to talk to him, which was super nice.
How often are you in touch with him?
Oh God, I don't talk to him that often. Maybe like we'll have a phone call like once every couple months.
A few times a year, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I've met him before in person. I think I've met him twice now. And yeah, he definitely everybody has a very unique relationship with him, and he is sort of a more complex piece of this puzzle. And I think, for people listening, who may have donor conceived children, I know that the donor is like the big fear, right? That they're going to like steal your children away from you or like destroy your family. And I can't impress enough that that is not the case. That will not happen. That has not happened. I just feel, you know, that one, it's crazy that I have to be grateful to be able to know the identity of my biological father, which is information that should belong to me. But further, like, I am grateful to be able to know him, and it's given me, you know, a sense, like, peace in understanding who I am. So,
when it comes to his decisions, his choices, did you want to know if he had a guess how many, if you have more siblings?
So we've talked about that as a group, and there are definitely more of us. We know that there are more of us, but we, you know, he doesn't know. He can't estimate, and we can't estimate. And, you know, we do know that some of the families bought out the banks when they created their families, and so to like limit the number of siblings. So we definitely have fewer than we originally would have because of that. But we have no idea, and there's no way of knowing how many of us there are, because the doctors don't keep track, the banks don't keep track, the donors don't keep track, and none of them are legally required to.
So a couple of points there. Do you think there should be a cap on how many donations a person can make, sperm donations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In every other country, basically, there is a cap. The United States is sort of the Wild West of fertility regulations in that we have none. And I think that it is irresponsible to not have a cap on the number of siblings, both because you can run into a situation where, you know, four of my siblings went to high school together and didn't know they were related. But also because it's, I think, unethical to, you know, do this to someone, because obviously I have 31 siblings and I try to have a relationship with all of them, but you can't have like, you can't have 31 best friends. You know, you can't have like a super, super close traditional sibling relationship with 31 people. And like, it occurred to me at one point, I remember after my dad died, that not only am I going to have a million nieces and nephews and a bunch of weddings to go to and all of that fun stuff, but I'm going to have to go to a lot of funerals, as morbid as that is. And having somebody, like, you know, creating a sort of postmodern family that's that huge puts this insane emotional burden on the people who are a part of it. And that's not to say that my siblings are a burden or that I don't love them. I do, but like, spreading yourself that thin emotionally can absolutely take a toll on your health.
Yeah. And you did mention to me before today that one of your other concerns is, I think in your words, being 82 years old and meeting a sister for the first time and thinking we lost decades of a relationship we didn't know we could have had.
Yeah.
And that could happen.
Sometimes, yeah, just thinking about, you know, I could be elderly and meet a brother or a sister who has spent their whole life not knowing I existed, who I spent my whole life not knowing they existed, and to just think about that amount of lost time. And I'm feeling that more profoundly as I get older. Like, I think it didn't feel quite as intense when I first found everybody, because I think I was like 22. But I'm like 26 now, you know, and we, like, my brother Andy, who we just met, is 27 and are going to be 27 in mid-April. And realizing that I missed not just like closer to 20 years with a brother, but closer to 30 years with somebody who I should have known the whole time, mm-hmm. you know, because my thought on it is they've been my brothers and sisters since the day both of us were born. And it's not our fault that we just were not granted the opportunity to know each other.
Talking to Lindsay Roble, who is telling her story and her family's story of being donor conceived and not knowing that until she was in her 20s. She has at least 30 siblings spread across this country and several others, almost certainly more that she has not met yet and doesn't know about, and very possible that those siblings don't know it either. And that is the story of Lindsay's family, but that's the story of a number of families of donor-conceived children who often don't find each other until later in life, don't know that one another are related. And so Lindsay's become an advocate for transparency laws. And there are certainly, as we mentioned, maybe some analogs here in the kind of conversation that the adopted community has about what do kids and eventually adults have the right to know about who their biological parents were, what those health markers may indicate, where their siblings may be, and what those relationships may be like if they only knew they had them. So let's take our only break here, and we're going to come back with Lindsay and a couple of her siblings, at least one of them whom she recently met. They'll tell their story as well on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a local school superintendent has written an open letter to Governor Andrew Cuomo and state leaders, urging them to quickly adopt what the CDC says is safe for kids in schools, a chance to bring kids, all kids, back full time to schools, not to wait any longer. We'll talk to the superintendent about why he says schools are ready on Tuesday.
On The Next Fresh Air, The Amazing Lives of Migratory Birds. Author Scott Wiedensahl talks about the millions of birds flying unseen over our heads in the night sky, how the bar-tailed godwit can fly more than a week over water without stopping, and how new tracking technology may help with strategies to keep them alive. His new book is A World on the Wing. Join us.
tonight at 7.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Lindsay Roble is with us, along with some of her siblings, and I will welcome them on the phone now. Now, part of the reason their story recently went viral again is Andy, who is on the line with us, one of the 31 siblings that they know.
Oh, Andy's going on first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, Andy. I don't know who. I think Andy's on. Are you there, Andy?
Yes, I am. Hi. How are y'all doing today?
Good. Where are you calling from? Where do we find you today, Andy?
So I live in Atlanta, Georgia right now.
Okay. I caught a y'all there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for making the time. We also have, I think, Hannah and Sterling as well. So I want to say hi to Hannah and Sterling, who I think are together. Hannah, can you do some introductions?
Hi. I'm Hannah, and I'm with my brother, Sterling. We are coming to you from California. Sterling, you want to say hi?
Hi.
Great to have you. Wow. I want to say to all three of you, and to Lindsay as well, I find this in many ways a beautiful family story. I'm sure it's been difficult at times for you, but I think talking about it publicly will certainly eventually help others who eventually navigate the same kinds of waters. And so I want to ask Andy if you could kind of take me through your own discovery process that led you decide to make that video that ends up going viral. Tell me about your story, Andy.
Right, yeah. So I actually bought these Ancestry DNA tests for me and both of my parents over Christmas. And I had no idea. This is a complete surprise. I had no idea the father I grew up with wasn't my biological father or anything like that. And they didn't react when I bought them the DNA test. So I didn't really know what was coming. A couple months passed by. I wake up one morning and see that my ethnicity looks different than I expected. Go over to the next page, and then I see a name under parent that isn't my dad's name. I Google that name, and then I find an article of the sperm donor father and 15 siblings all partying it up in Mexico. And that was the first thing I saw.
What goes through your mind at that point, Andy?
It's hard to describe. Mainly, it was beautiful. Seeing, like, you know, obviously the first thing I did is go on social media and try and find all these people. And you know, the first thing that struck me is how many of their vocal patterns and phrasings and things were just so spot on. And I just realized it had to be true.
What did you feel about your mom and dad that you grew up with and the knowledge that you didn't have until now about this, Andy?
Yeah, so this is still, I mean, just over a month ago I found this out. So it's very fresh. At the moment, I'm honestly struggling with it because my parents, who I thought have done a stellar job raising me with loving kindness for most of my life, did something that I truly disagree with and essentially lied to me my whole life about something incredibly important to me. And it's been a struggle, and it seems like from the research that I've done and from the talks I've had with other siblings that finding out earlier is generally better when it comes to acceptance about finding something like this out with your family.
Lindsay, that's exactly what you were saying earlier in the program. Have you wanted to sort of reach out to Andy and maybe understanding what he's dealing with, that feeling of, I love my mom and dad, but they did lie to me. You went through that. Are you helping others navigate that when they encounter that emotion, Lindsay?
You know, that's always sort of when we find a new sibling who didn't know, I always just shoot them a text and say, hey, you know, I've been through it. I also found out as an adult, if you ever need to talk, I'm here. And, you know, Andy and I have gotten pretty close and talked about it a bunch. And I hope I've been helpful. I've been trying to be helpful. I always just kind of have been saying, like, you know, the best time to tell your kids is when they're kids. The second best time is now. So
I think that's well said. So Andy, I mean, look, I don't want to, you know, sort of like to use a cliche, I don't want to put you on the couch over this. I know it's fresh, and I'm sure there's going to be a process that you work through. But clearly you feel that your mom and dad that you've grown up with love you. Had they told you why they decided not to give you the truth on this?
Yeah, so for my dad's side, they were just scared that it would fundamentally change the relationship that we had. And, you know, especially in my teenage years, early teenage years, my parents split up and I did, had a kind of a rocky period with my relationship with my father, but we've gotten closer over time. And I think they were scared that that was going to kind of shake the situation on that end. For my mother, it's a lot more interesting and a lot deeper. So she is a Muslim woman. Her family is all from the Middle East. She's a first generation immigrant. And there's no verse in the Quran about donor conception. And she didn't want her family to find out and reject her for her only way to have a biological child, because in the Quran, the adoption is not necessarily viewed in the same light as it is in Western cultures either. So this was their only solution to have a biological kid. And that's tough, you know?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I mean, look, I admire you for being direct about how this news has hit you while also saying, you know, my mom and dad made complex decisions for complex reasons. I don't agree with it, but I can at least try to understand why they did it. And then do you think you can heal out of this going forward, Andy?
I think that's what I'm figuring out right now. The grief that I've felt for the time that I've lost with my siblings. And, you know, specifically when I think of times where I struggled and I could have used that network. I mean, I have a sister and a niece that lived in Seattle at the same time that I lived there, 30 minutes away. I could have seen them. Wow. When I was on that side of the country. And that hits hard. And the hardest part is knowing or not knowing what capacity I'm going to be able to forgive them.
Wow. Well, I mean, you've got a really remarkable set of siblings who are lifting you up, it looks like. I mean, 31 of you now, who knows how many? I mean, I'm laughing out of the sheer, like, you shrug your shoulders and you say, wow, like, what else don't we know? I'm not laughing at the situation. I mean,
of course, yeah. And I've been so lucky to have such an incredibly supportive group of people. I mean, I found out just a month ago, but I've been on phone calls and FaceTimes for, I would say, you know, a work week worth of time. So, and they've been incredible to me.
It's been the craziest.
And directly to y'all, thank you also.
Oh, wow. I know it's been a wild month for you, and it's not one that you saw coming here, and then you make this TikTok video and it kind of goes viral. you I guess look to me in that video like you just wanted to tell a little story, and you had almost two dozen of your siblings popping up saying hello. Did you expect that to go anywhere, Andy?
So I essentially, my friends were just as excited for me as I was, it felt like, at times figuring all of this out. And I had a couple of friends that were like, you have to do something on social media about this. It absolutely would be massive. And me and Brooklyn, one of my other sisters, have been really hitting it hard with trying to get everybody to participate and making these little videos. And they've done incredibly well. I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised, because it is an incredible story. It's really cool to see people's reactions to it.
I think it's a great thing, because it's you know, your story, your family story, is not the only one like this, and that's part of why I know that the advocacy is happening. Let me ask some of your other siblings if Hannah and Sterling can kind of tell their own story. I'll turn to Hannah next. Go ahead, Hannah.
Hey. So I found out about a year and a half ago now.
And Sterling and I have pretty different stories. Mine is a lot closer to Andy's and Lindsay's. I found out through a 23andMe test. My mom told me the news as the 23andMe results were kind of on their way back to me. Wow. And she flew down to New Orleans where I was living at the time and said, "Hey, I have something kind of serious to tell you." And we sat down and she just cried for a long time. And I was like, "Oh God, is somebody in the family not okay?" And she's like, no, everybody's safe. And I was like, "Okay, what is going on?" And she was like, told the story in kind of a strange way. She was acting very strange. So I knew that it was about to be a life changing moment. And she said, "You know, we had trouble conceiving. We used a sperm donor. That's probably your father, biologically." And I just laughed for like 5 minutes because it was one of these moments where 24 years of unanswered questions all came into focus, like in an instant.
What was an example of one of those questions?
Like why my personality is the way that it is, why I'd had such an intense disconnect with my father growing up. Him and I have had a really hard relationship pretty much the entire time. And trying to bridge this gap of why are we so different yet we're related had been a really prominent question of my life. And all of a sudden I understood.
Were you angry?
Not at first. At first, I was relieved to have the truth that kind of like recolored my entire past and put it into proper framing. It's almost like I had been looking for an answer to something that wasn't quite sitting right for my entire life, and having the answer felt relieving. The anger came later. And I'm still pretty angry, to be honest.
Do you agree with your siblings who have said there's an obligation to tell the truth at the earliest age possible?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that all people have a right to their accurate genetic information, their accurate family medical history. I'm one of the siblings who had a pretty debilitating medical condition that could have been alleviated by accurate information. I had really debilitating migraines in high school, and migraines were listed in the donor profile. I don't believe that, particularly once people become 18, that anyone has the right to withhold that information.
Wow. A listener named Scott writes to say, "Evan, I'm amazed at how similar this issue sounds to adoption. So many similar issues. I love that this is being discussed. It is so validating to know that there are others out there who have had similar struggles." I mean, you guys are helping people. Hannah, how are you doing with this, like, today? How close are you with some of your siblings now?
Well, I have been I kind of unintentionally ended up cohabitating with Sterling here for the past 3 months, and we've just had a fantastic time. Connecting with my new half-siblings has brought so many gifts into my life. I really struggle to encapsulate that in a few words, but like I've had the privilege of collaborating with some of them on projects over the past year, which has just been like so profound and fulfilling in a way that is hard to describe. Like this meeting of the minds is really phenomenal.
Amazing. 30 siblings, a lot of them around the same age. I mean, roughly half of this group of siblings born in the year 1994, number of mm-hmm. others born in 1995. Sterling, can you tell me a little bit about your story?
Yeah. So speaking of similarities to adoption, I feel I'm a little the odd one out here. My story's pretty different from everyone else on the call right now, but also really similar in lots of ways. I grew up as an only child, and my mom had me using both a sperm donor and an egg donor when she was 49. So hence the reason, you know, why she had to use an egg donor to be safe. But I've been very much, an odd one out in my family my whole life, and still not entirely understanding why, even though my mom actually told me so young that I don't remember a single moment. You know, I remember some moments of seeing the donor packets, seeing Daly's packet, seeing my egg donor's packet, and there was a really bad photocopy of a picture of her on the front that just blew my mind. But even with all that, it's never been a huge concern or a question for me. I just got curious one day when Amazon had a 50% off sale on 23andMe, and I'm like, I guess I should kind of get this over with. it was more life-changing than I ever could have imagined, honestly. So I've known my whole life, but even then, there are some things that, because I wasn't adopted, even though for sometimes I refer to it as like it's adoption with extra steps, because I'm not genetically related to my mom who carried me and gave birth to me. So we're very different, it's kind of a similar situation. I'm super different from her and kind of understood why when I was little, but never like fully grasped it because of the way that was framed differently from adoption. So like, whereas I think it might be more likely for an adopted child to get family therapy at a younger age, working through that, I didn't really get that because it's just kind of assumed that it's different and she gave birth to me, so why is it any different? It's been life-changing in a very different and similar way.
Wow. What an amazing 23andMe bringing lots of siblings together. That's that is remarkable. So let me just work in a couple questions from listeners. Patrick says, just wondering, are there qualifiers to become a donor? Like, are there do they do any sort of tracking of personality, other background checks, criminal records checks, et cetera. Just wondering, Patrick's wondering, what are all the things that a donor has to do or not do? I'm going to kick that to Lindsay. Can you answer that one, Lindsay?
Yeah. So donors, as far as I'm aware, medical history is entirely self-reported. So, anybody can lie. They definitely have to test like sperm motility and whatnot. And I feel like I've heard that a very small number of people actually are able to pass that test, but there are some weird things. Like at some banks, you can pay more for donors that are more highly educated, and some banks have like height requirements, which I find like bordering on eugenics a little bit. Don't love that. Mm-hmm. Typically donors are like educated, physically healthy people, but I don't think most banks do background checks, and I know that there's no like genetic testing really. It's all medical history is generally all self-reported.
Well, other countries have abolished anonymity in this process in recent years, and as our guests have mentioned, the United States has not. So some of the things that they are advocating for include, and there's some disagreement on this one, a potential limit on the number of offspring that can result for one donor. Anonymous donors, no more. That's a pretty universal call from the donor-conceived advocacy community. The banks who promise anonymous donation often now, especially with 23andMe and everything else happening, people tend to find out. And so that's almost a false promise. But the question is, can there be laws around that? Are people entitled to know their biological parents? Should it be illegal to knowingly falsify a birth certificate in this way? And should banks be forced to keep not only better records, but a communication line with doctors to find out if there's been conception and birth? Lindsay, does that cover most of the list that you and many of your siblings are advocating for?
Yeah, that's, I think, everything that I told you. I think doctors and banks should absolutely be responsible for keeping track of how many of us there are. When I found everybody, Mackenzie told me that she had called California Cryobank to register her own birth when she turned 18, and that she was the first live birth that they found out about from this donor. And like, I believe most of us are from California Cryobank.
And Hannah, if I could just ask Hannah, in our last minute or so, Any guidance or thoughts you would share with people who might eventually find themselves in this situation?
I would say know that you're not alone. There are a limited number of resources and like literature that exists around the issue of donor conception, but there are some and they make a huge difference. There is a Facebook group. There's a website called WeAreDonorConceived.com that curates a lot of resources on curates a lot of resources for donor conceived people. And I would also say, if you can swing it financially, get a therapist who is versed in fertility issues at the very least, or adoption. And remember that grief is a huge ongoing part of this process, and processing and healing are not linear in any way, and it's going to be a roller coaster, and that's okay.
Mental health is health. I think that's really good advice. And I would just say to Andy, who I suspect Andy's going to eventually talk to new siblings you don't know yet, and maybe your own counsel will help them through this. Let me thank all of you. Andy, thanks for making the time, thanks for making that video, and thanks for coming on with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Hannah, Sterling, thanks for making time to call the program, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for hosting.
Of course, man. Thanks for having us.
And Lindsay Roble, I don't know if all of your siblings are as kind as the ones who are on this program.
They are. I just want to say quick before we go out, if you're listening to this and your kid is donor conceived, please tell them. Please tell them. They have a right to know, and it will make their life better once you tell them.
Beautiful and strong words. Thank you, Lindsay. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having us, Evan.
What a remarkable hour of conversation. Thanks to Tim Shea, volunteering, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan. We'll talk tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.